I'm Anthony Brabazon.
And I'm Paul Caffrey.
And this is the God Talk programme for the next half hour on 90.3 Near FM, where we'll be grappling with the big questions of life from a biblical perspective.
Our text number during the programme is 087 69 44 500, and we'd love to hear from you. You can also email on nearfmgodtalk@gmail.com, and you can get us on Twitter at nearfmgodtalk.
And we also have a companion website at godtalkradioblog@wordpress.com. So that's a good place to go for resources. Mm-hmm. And greetings go out today to our stalwart friend Mick O'Brien, who does the Sunday morning.
Thanks for that, Mick. We appreciate that a lot.
And Mick was throwing away tickets for Charlie Lansborough on Sunday, I have to say. No better man. John Ahern also wants to say hello to Suzanne, Ruth Riley, Enzo, Desi, Ian Campbell of the Beulah Christian Bookshop in Newcastle County Down.
Beulah,
sorry.
A good friend of mine. I always go in there when I'm up that part of the world.
Well, we were up there. Myself and my wife were there at the weekend and we cleaned them out.
One of the best stock bookshops in Ireland. Actually, Spencer Jones has been there with me. He's brought some stuff back to America from Beulah Bookshop.
Well, I'm impressed with that anyway. And also a big hi to you, Billy Diego. I'll be over for the cup of tea later, so just hold fire and I'll see you soon. And thanks also to our podcast staff at Near FM, Paul, and especially to Donny, who's recovering from his hip operation. I heard it went very well, so hi to you, Donny.
Hi, Donny.
And so we're going to move on. I have to start off this week and tell you what I did last weekend, the weekend just gone.
Go ahead.
We took a break and we went up to Northern Ireland, and we stayed in a lovely hotel. It was called the Old Inn. And it's in a little village beside Bangor. And it's a very interesting history because C.S. Lewis stayed there with Joy Gresham on his honeymoon night. And there's a big plaque on the wall that says that. Huh. In fact, the Wi-Fi password even has C.S. Lewis in it.
Really?
Yeah. So they're very proud and happy of that news. And a beautiful, beautiful place we stayed in. So, you know, we were talking, Paul, about C.S. Lewis last week.
That's
we
right.
did a special program on...
The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, we'd some great extracts from that. That was a children's book with a really deep meaning. But C.S. Lewis was also used during the Second World War.
Yeah, he was a very versatile man. As we know, he not only was in Northern Ireland on his honeymoon, in fact, he was born in Belfast in 1898 and he died in 1963. He died the same day, in fact, as John F. Kennedy, November 23rd, 1963.
Yeah, that's why he didn't make the headlines.
He didn't make the headlines when he died. But he wrote lots of other kind of books. He wrote science fiction. He had his famous science fiction trilogy. He wrote in his own field, which is English literature, but he also wrote some Christian apologetics.
Apologies? Why would you have to apologise?
No, nothing to do with apologies at all. Apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which means a defence.
All right.
And a famous occurrence of that in the New Testament, when Peter in his first letter writes in chapter 3, telling the believers to be always prepared to make a defence to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. So it's kind of making the reasonable case and a defence, a rational, reasonable defence for Christianity. It's not the same as evangelism. Evangelism goes a lot further, proclaims very explicitly the good news of Christ and demands and invites a response. So apologetics is kind of doing the groundwork. It's kind of explaining that Christianity isn't a crazy idea, that it's rational, that it's reasonable, that it's believable. And in fact, C.S. Lewis, in the Introduction to Mere Christianity, says that his purpose is to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times. So it's making a reasonable defence for what Christians believe.
But in today's culture, Paul, don't you think there's a huge need for that? Because people, like in, dare I use the word, snowflake generation, you know, things are very surface and emotional and shallow, really. And so people dismiss God on a whim. You know, maybe there was some bad experience for somebody in the past and they just throw everything out.
So you're really starting from something very basic, from people who don't believe there's a God at all. You know, it's extremely basic. So there was a time, maybe a generation, a couple of generations ago, you could start maybe with the Scriptures, with the New Testament, and people took that as given, as true.
That's right. Yeah, now you have to come right back to the creation. It's a bit like Paul on Mars Hill, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, you know, with the philosophers and all of that. But anyway, so Mere Christianity was his masterpiece of apologetics, and I think we referred to it last week. It's a book based on a series. It's a classic of Christian apologetics. even though it was written in the 1940s and 50s, it still speaks to us today. Mere Christianity, based on a series of radio talks given on the BBC during World War II. The BBC director of religious broadcasting at the time had read one of C.S. Lewis's books, The Problem of Pain, which is one of the books in which he deals with the whole question of the problem of evil and pain in the world. And he thought this man would be a good person to speak words of encouragement to listeners out there during the very, very dark days of the Second World War. So Lewis got these few broadcast slots and he was just inundated with mail. It was hugely popular. So up to that time, he was practically unknown in the UK and England.
Yeah, we probably underestimate the power of radio in something like wartime Britain, or you know, or when things were the pressure was really on, you know, how important it was to put the right people out there.
So he goes through things very systematically, as I say, kind of preparing the ground for people to show them the reasonableness of Christianity. And one of the biggest problems, of course, for believers and indeed for non-believers is the whole question of the problem of evil. And C.S. Lewis had already written The Problem of Pain to address the question. And so I thought today we'd look at one chapter from Mere Christianity which addresses this big question. We say on our intro that we deal with the big questions of life. So here's a big one: why pain? And at the end of the preceding chapter, Lewis refers to the dark power at work in the universe and says that we're living as part of the in a part of the universe occupied by the rebel. So against that background, he sort of says, well, how come there's a rebellion? How come there's evil? If God is so good, why would he allow this kind of thing? Why would he allow the earth effectively to be taken over by rebel forces?
Right, so here we are. We're going straight into the vault.
So it's called A Shocking Alternative. This is C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. Christians then believe that an evil power has made himself, for the present, the prince of this world. And of course, that raises problems. Is this state of affairs in accordance with God's will or not? If it is, he's a strange God, you will say. And if it's not, how can anything happen contrary to the will of a being with absolute power? But anyone who has been in authority knows how a thing can be in accordance with your will in one way and not in another. It may be quite sensible for a mother to say to the children, I'm not going to go and make you tidy the room every night. You've got to learn to keep it tidy on your own. Then she goes up one night and finds the teddy bear and the ink and the French grammar all lying on the grate. That is against her will. She would prefer the children to be tidy. But on the other hand, it is her will which has left the children free to be untidy. The same thing arises in any regiment or trade union or school. You make a thing voluntary and then half the people don't do it. That's not what you willed, but your will has made it possible. It's probably the same in the universe. God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go either wrong or right. Some people think they can imagine a creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong. I cannot. If a thing is free to do good, it's also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why then did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. A world of automata, creatures that work like machines, would hardly be worth creating. The happiness which God designs for his higher creatures is the happiness of being freely, voluntarily united to him and to each other in an ecstasy of love and delight, compared with which the most rapturous love between a man and a woman on this earth is mere milk and water. And so for that, they must be free. Of course, God knew what would happen if they used their freedom in the wrong way. Apparently, he thought it worth the risk. When we have understood about free will, we shall see how silly it is to ask, as somebody once asked me, why did God make a creature of such rotten stuff that it went wrong? Well, the better stuff a creature is made of, the cleverer and stronger and freer it is, then the better it will be if it goes right, but also the worst if it goes wrong. A cow cannot be very good or very bad. A dog can be both better and worse. A child better and worse still. An ordinary man still more so. A man of genius still more so. And a superhuman spirit best or worst of all. How did the dark power go wrong? Here, no doubt, we ask a question to which human beings cannot give an answer with any certainty. A reasonable and traditional guess based on our own experience of going wrong can, however, be offered. The moment you have a self at all, there's the possibility of putting yourself first, wanting to be the center, wanting to be God, in fact. That was the sin of Satan, and that was the sin he taught the human race. What Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up on their own as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside God, apart from God. And out of that hopeless attempt has come nearly all that we call human history. Money, power, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empire, slavery, the whole long terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. The reason why it can never succeed is this. God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. The car is made to run on petrol and it would not run properly on anything else. Now God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it's just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself because it's not there. There is no such thing. And that is the key to history. Terrific energy is expended, civilizations are built up, excellent institutions devised. But each time something goes wrong, some fatal flaw always brings the selfish and cruel people to the top and it all slides back into misery and ruin. In fact, the machine conks. It seems to start up all right, runs a few yards, and then it breaks down. They are trying to run it on the wrong juice. That is what Satan has done to humans.
That's so good, isn't it, all of that? You know, God designed the human machine to run on himself.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you forget everything today, that's worth remembering, is how God's plan. But then the other thing, Paul, really struck me as you were reading that was he thought it was worth the risk.
Mm-hmm.
When God created mankind, he put in that most dangerous ingredient, which was called free will.
Yeah.
And free will, as explained by that passage, you
know,
because it goes both ways.
Yeah, if you just think of ordinary human love, you don't want to be loved by compulsion. You wouldn't have to think your wife was
staying
with you.
Doesn't work that way.
Just because she had to, just because it was illegal to walk away or something.
I remember when I was a child, we'd be off at a kid's party or something and I'd be brought back and get out of the car and I'd be just about to say to the person who dropped me back, thank you very much. And my mother would give me this unmerciful poke in the back and say, did you thank Mrs. Murphy? And suddenly all the spontaneity and the goodness and the genuineness of me saying thank you was gone.
Yeah.
You know, and when you bring compulsion into something, you lose all that. But
one thing I find interesting, he is, I think, very modern the way he refers to Satan as the dark power.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of Jesus referring to the ruler of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Apostle Paul in Ephesians speaks about the prince of the world, of the power of the air, who was at work in the sons of disobedience. Very, very powerful. And well, Jesus refers to him several times as the ruler of this world.
Yeah, what we really have going on down here is a clash of kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is the kingdom of this world, you know, and then there is the kingdom of God. And Jesus, of course, introduced the kingdom of God, made it possible for mankind to be under the leadership directly of God himself. See, kingdom's about a king and a subject, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? It's about somebody saying yes to what the king
exactly.
says.
It's but not saying it freely and saying it in love and loyalty. You've sort of brought me onto my second excerpt, should I?
No, well, I tell you, before
you
we do that, I have something here which is really
music.
Special.
Okay.
It's a musical interlude, and it's by Chris Tomlin, is the musician. And when they brought out talking about C.S. Lewis, they brought out films of the Narnia films in recent years, and they inspired a lot of musicians to write pieces of music. And this is a piece from Chris Tomlin, and it's called You're the One. That was the wonderful sound of Chris Tomlin, some music inspired by Narnia.
Good.
Isn't that wonderful?
Still
so you're listening to 90.3 Near FM. This is the God Talk programme. We're here every Monday at 5 o'clock to 5:30. Anthony Brabazon speaking, and we have Paul Caffrey as well. And what we, if you wish to join the discussion here, you can text us in at 087 69 44 500. As we're looking here, the shocking alternative. It's from C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity.
Okay.
So we have another portion. Do you want to just give it to us straight, Paul?
Okay, let's finish
right
the second half of the chapter. And what did God do? First of all, he left his conscience, the sense of right and wrong. And all through history, there have been people trying, some of them very hard, to obey it. None of them ever quite succeeded. Secondly, he sent the human race what I call good dreams. I mean, those queer stories scattered all through the heathen religions about a god who dies and comes to life again, and by his death has somehow given life to men. Thirdly, he selected one particular people and spent several centuries hammering into their heads the sort of god he was, that there was only one of him, and that he cared about right conduct. Those people were the Jews, and the Old Testament gives an account of the hammering process. Then comes the real shock. Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he was God. He claims to forgive sins. He says that he has always existed. He says he's coming to judge the world at the end of time. Now, let us get this clear. Among pantheists like the Indians, anyone might say that he was a part of God or one with God. There would be nothing very odd about it. But this man, since he was a Jew, could not mean that kind of God. God in their language meant the being outside the world who had made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said was quite simply the most shocking thing that had ever been uttered by human lips. One part of the claim tends to slip past us unnoticed because we have heard it so often that we no longer see what it amounts to. I mean the claim to forgive sins, any sins. Now, unless the speaker is God, this is really so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offences against himself. You tread on my toes and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what should we make of a man, himself unrobbed and untrodden on, who announced that he forgave you for treading on other men's toes and stealing other men's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. Yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he himself were party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offences. This makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as silliness and conceit unrivalled by any other character in history. Yet, and this is the strange, significant thing, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not usually get the impression of silliness and conceit. Still less do unprejudiced readers. Christ says that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we would attribute to some of his sayings. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil in hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall down at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
Wow, well, that's a real, real challenge, because you cannot leave this, as he's just said, you know, you can't just call him a good moral teacher. Mm-hmm. And Paul, I just have to say that in a lot of my discussions with people on the street and even some of the Vox Pops we did, you know, in the previous weeks, people were saying that, you know, they'd say he's a good person. Jesus,
that's right.
Good person, you know, but they wouldn't see him as God.
No.
The challenge is, I don't know why that is. I think some of it's ignorance, there's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is the moral challenge of it. Because the moral challenge, if you realise that he is God, you know, if there is a God, it does reflect on your own life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that because I've been there myself. I know what it's like. But I mean, the amazing thing is this balance between the love of God and the holiness of God, that God is so loving that he'd actually do something to get man back into that relationship, so that, like he said earlier, like a car fueled by petrol, you know, man can be fueled by God.
Exactly. And as C.S. Lewis had said in the previous chapter, and I think I've quoted that before, he says, enemy occupied territory, that's what this world is. But Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed, you might say, landed in disguise, and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage. Yeah. And of course, that campaign of sabotage starts with me.
Yeah.
It starts in my heart.
Well, explain that, sabotage.
Sabotage is to...
to ruin the enemy's plans.
To ruin the enemy is to come in and destroy the enemy plans. Because, you see, the word Satan means an adversary, someone who obstructs. You know, Jesus says that the devil, he came to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life. And that's the sabotage. He came to take all these people who are in various degrees and in various ways under that dominion, under that dark power, as C.S. Lewis calls it, in a very 21st century way, and to actually bring them into a new kingdom. That's what we had in Colossians a few weeks ago. He has transferred us from the dominion of darkness to the kingdom of his own son.
Yeah, in one of C.S. Lewis' books, The Last Battle, actually, it talks about Aslan, who was representative of Christ, and Tash, who was representative of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And then they created this creature called Tashlan, which was a mixture, and it confused the people, because it was pretending to be God, but it was the devil.
Kind of an antichrist, in the sense of someone in place of Christ.
Yeah, but many people attribute to God the character of the devil. That's a very blunt thing to say. That was said by Wayne Jacobson once.
In what sense? No, what do you mean by that?
It means that people blame God for a whole load of stuff that he never did. You see, all the destruction, the killing, stealing and destroying is the enemy's work, you know. And people point to God as, you know, when there's things go all wrong in their lives and everything, you know, they often blame God. Now, we know God is a God of judgment, but at the same time, he is often so much of what goes on is the disruptive work of the enemy.
Sure.
See, God's the creator. Here's the thing. He made things, and all the enemy ever did is corrupted the things God made.
Sure.
He's not a creative guy.
He's an adversary. He's just
kind of guy who goes to the beach where the kids make their sandcastle and he wrecks all the sandcastles.
Sure.
That's what he does. So anyway, our time is short as always, but we do have a prayer at the end of this program, you know, and we have Psalm 25.
And this is really a prayer, isn't it? Asking God, I suppose, to open, to teach us some of these truths, to bring us onto his wavelength, as it were.
That's right. And, you know, we're here every Friday. Oh, not every Friday, sorry, every Monday.
Every Monday.
I don't know what's happened to me since I went up to that north of Ireland. My brain isn't straight. But so we're here every Monday, 5 to 5.30. You can get us on the podcast on the Near FM website. So listen back to previous programs. So Psalm 25 says, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. And for you are the God of my salvation. On you I wait all the day. Remember, O Lord, your tender mercies and your loving kindness. For they are from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth, nor my transgression. According to your mercy, remember me, for your goodness' sake, O Lord. Now that's part of Psalm 25.
And good prayer.
You know, should really encourage you, listeners. So thanks again for listening in today. And it's been a pleasure and a blessing. So we're going to sign off now and see you next week.
Until next week. Good evening, listeners.
Same time. God bless you.